This is the Truth Frequency Radio Network.
We are TFR.
Truth Frequency Radio.
Australia and all around the world, wherever you may be, I'm your host, Nikki Colombo, and welcome to the Nikki Colombo Show. Tonight we have a very special guest on. Michelle Emma DeChamps is on, and he is a former MUFON member and former provincial section director of Sunbury, Ontario, Canada. And since July 1974, he has had 27 separate UFO sightings, including two captured on video. He has appeared on numerous radio and television programs, including Midday Q in the North, MCTV Today, three local stations, Vault TFO, and the Camilla Scott Show CTV, just to name a few. He was also featured in local press, which includes the Sunbury Star, the Northern Life, the Lambda-Laurentian University publication, the Cambrian Shield, Cambrian College publication, and the South Side Story. He's contributed valuable information to American researcher Jan Aldrich Project's 1947, which earned him an acknowledgement of his work in Jan's book Project 1947, a preliminary report on the 1947 UFO sighting wave. He continues to inform the public about UFOs and flying saucers by lecturing on the subject, and has written several letters to the editor about his and other people's eyewitness accounts. He also wrote a few articles which have appeared in the Canadian Ufologist, the MUFON Ontario's new letter, now defunct. His expertise lies in researching Northern Ontario newspaper archives for UFO reports and UFO-related information. Apart from those retrieved from the Sunbury Star, both he and his colleague, Todd Fraser, have located hundreds of new clippings within the pages of the Salt Star, the Timmins Daily Press, the Kirkland Lake Northern Daily News, and the North Bay Nugget. Since 2007, he has worked on creating a website originally based on the research that he did using the newspaper archive at Laurentian University, NUFORS, N-O-U-F-O-R-S, Northern Ontario UFO Research and Study, has expanded to include a wide range of UFOlogical information gathered from international sources, everything from sightings made by astronauts and police officers to physical trace evidence left by landed objects of unknown origin. He presents the hard facts to the best of his abilities and encourages the reader to look at the material with an open mind. Oh, you got a lot of those here, that's for sure, sweaty. With an open mind and perhaps learning something new and fascinating along the way. So, welcome, Michelle, to the show. Woohoo!
Thank you, Nikki.
Oh, it's an honour to have you on here. Sweetie, do you want to start by telling us, how did this all start for you?
That's a question that's been asked many times. I'm not sure if it was the sighting that came first when I was 9 years old or the interest. I would say probably the sighting. And then I started researching a few years after that. But that initial first sighting wasn't really confirmed until many, many years later when I bought a book at a secondhand bookstore. And it turns out that there was a chapter about Sudbury, Ontario and Eastern Townships. And the dates matched pretty well. From my recollection, the date when I was in the area when I had my first sighting.
That seems to be be the pattern with a lot of us where we have a lot of experiences when we're younger and we don't quite understand it. And it's not until years later when we start to do research that we start to join the dots. And then we realize and we start to go on this amazing journey of this fascinating subject that, you know, all my listeners are really involved with in so many different areas. What do you reckon?
It's pretty well the same across the board, whether you talk about ghost investigators or UFO investigators. I mean, I've looked into everything, Bermuda Triangle, Virgin Mary apparitions, ghosts, Bigfoot, UFOs became my specialty for some reason. I did not know I was going to have so many sightings that would convince me. Well, actually, I got convinced after the first 10 sightings. Before that, I wasn't too sure. But it's across the board. And 9 years old, 9 years of age seems to be a common thread as well for people who are into the paranormal. And trust me, once you get into that world, it's pretty hard to close the floodgates, as they say.
I know. Do you know what? I've had many giggles with many of my guests. And I always reference Richard Dreyfuss from Close Encounters of the Third Kind and how obsessive and manic he was when he first had that sighting, and then he starts to build that big, you know, he gets all the pot plants and, you know, I mean, like, we weren't all that obsessive, but, you know, it's just such a fascinating subject. You can't put it down. It is something that triggers inside our DNA that wakes us up to the fact that we actually have galactic family out there, and there's good guys and there's, you know, there's negative guys, and we all have to navigate through these energies as we get older. But looking back in hindsight, it's a fantastic tool, isn't it? Because I remember when I was about 19, 20, and I found this some scoop mark just, you know, down the bottom, you know, right on my left ovary. And for years I didn't know what that was until, you know, much later, 20 years later, I realized, okay, scoop marks, missing time, all, you know, all the traditional patterns that, you know, that a lot of people talk about. And I thought, okay, I didn't realize that I was having contact such as at such a young age, and didn't realize what scoop marks were all about until much later on. And now that I've gotten right into the subject, it's a real passion for me. It's not as an obsession as for me as what I used to be years ago, when I tried to go around red pilling everyone because they would just freak out. And it just, that's not the way to go about it. You have to kind of bring them in a little bit more gently, because it's frightening, because people don't really understand what's going on. But once they start to when you start to understand a lot of this information, all the fear is dissipated, and that's what this show is all about. So, okay, so let's go back to when you're 9 years of age. What did the ship look like? And then carry on from there about how you progressed into where you are today.
Well, actually, it wasn't a ship per se. Actually, it was a metallic sphere. Mm-hmm. And I would say maybe probably, in relation to my size at the time, I would say it was probably a meter in diameter. Mm-hmm. And it was floating just above the tree line. And if I remember correctly, I think I looked at it wondering, like, okay, is it a tethered balloon? Is it an advertisement balloon? But there was no advertisement on it. There was no chain or rope tying it down to the ground. And at that time, all there was a couple of U-Haul trailers, like trailers that we can rent to move stuff around, like when you're moving from one residence to another or whatever. And then there was a gravel, a parking lot size area, just with maybe gravel, and now it's all built up with homes. And so I remember looking in that direction. I just happened to be at this building where they used to have finger painting for the young kids. And then on the second floor of this building is where the teenagers would hold their dances. And that building is no longer there, but I just happened to be outside. And the reason why I think it was the summer was because the reflection of the sun on the object, the fact that my brother's birthday was July 13th, and later on when I found that book, the sightings were between July 12th and July 15th, 1974.
Wow.
And so I'm assuming that it would have been the perfect place for my mom to shoo us out of the house and just go to the end of the street where we would do finger painting and stuff like that on my brother's birthday. And I just happened to be standing outside, leaning against the back wall. And that's when I noticed the object. Now, for a long time, I thought it was something maybe I copied off TV or just memorized from somewhere. I wasn't sure if I really had the sighting. But when I bought the book, not only was I surprised to find out that other people had had similar sighting, but at about the same time, there was a Canadian Pacific Airlines flight from Montreal to Winnipeg that just happened to be flying above Sudbury at that time. It encountered a 100-foot diameter disc, and the pilot took evasive maneuver twice and apparently had all the passengers look out the same side of the plane, look out the window, and they could all see the object. But this was only referenced in the book. I've never seen or found any documents anywhere related to that. But the regular sightings, like what I saw, the spherical objects, I did later on purchase 5 microfilm reels from our own National Archives, and I found 2 pages that pertain to that particular sighting.
Wow, isn't it amazing how big these ships really are? I don't think people realize until you actually see one in real life about how big these things really are. And now silent, too.
I mean, if it was man-made, the noise would be tremendous.
Yes, exactly. You know? And how with my sightings, it's amazing how they just zip straight up into the sky, or they take a 90-degree angle, and yeah, I can tell that they're going into some, you know, other dimension. And I've also seen them how they've just suck in, like it's like they become a light, like they power up, become a light, and then that light goes smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and then kind of just sucks out, just like, you know, as if you're going down a drain or down a vortex, and just the, you know, the ball gets smaller and smaller of light, and then it just kind of disappears, and you go, oh, my God, that's just amazing. And thank God I had people around me, because I'm like, did you see that? And they're like, see, but I'm not crazy after all. Okay, like that seems to be the same phrase that people say over and over and over again when you say to someone, see, I told you, I'm not crazy after all, huh? And we're not crazy, and that's why we're here documenting. A lot of people say we should be rewriting the history books. So we're doing that right now by, I have people on my show giving, like, these are actual witness testimonies, and a lot of people are writing books right now. So we are changing the course of history right now for the history books for our future generations, and that's why we're doing this show. Okay, so after that, did your brother see it, by the way, or were you the only one?
I was, as far as I know, I was the only one who saw it. I looked far to my left, and I saw a guy with a baseball glove and a bat playing with a ball. That was it. He was just by himself out in the baseball field adjacent to the property where I was. But I think I was the only one at the time. I mean, but obviously the documents mention other people having seen these, what they described as bluish, silvery spheres maneuvering around.
Oh, okay, cool. All right. Now, okay, so then what happened after that?
After that, I didn't have a sighting until almost like 20 years later. 15, because I was 9 years old at that time, and my next sighting was when it was in the early 90s. It was October 1990, as a matter of fact, October 9th, and I was in my early 20s then. So, and plus, because we live close to an airport, I was already getting myself familiarized with airplanes, how they look at night, and helicopters and whatever else. And the radar base was also not far, exactly eye to eye level. If you went from one hilltop where the airport was located and look over to the other hilltop, you'd be exactly in line with the radar base, which is no longer there. But that's where eventually, at the end of my sighting, that's where the object was the very last time I saw it.
I've seen one that's been right. I was actually picking somebody up from the airport, and it was very late at night, and I was crossing the Tugan Bypass on the Gold Coast to go onto the Gold Coast Highway, and, of course, I missed the turnoff because this great big triangle black melted rock looking, you know, ship, just a huge ship just appeared straight in front of my eyes. And and I missed a turnoff, and the guy in the car said to me, "See, I'm not crazy after all." And I was absolutely flabbergasted. It was so close. And then I had to do a turnaround and come back again to try and get on the freeway. But, you know, my jaw was just dropped all the way. And, you know, it just, it appeared. It was like it was waiting for me. It appeared, bang, and then it disappeared, bang. And I'm like, oh, my God. And because it was so late at night, there was nobody else on the road. So they kind of, you know, gave us a little bit of a hello there, and that was right near the airport. So there must be something going on, some sort of correlation there, guys, with the airports and seeing these ships that kind of flash at you and then they disappear. It's like they're kind of saying, you know, hello, we're here. Whether or not it was back engineering or not, I'm not quite sure. Who knows? It's very hard to tell, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so after that, how did you get into MUFON? MUFON, guys, is when I first saw, for my Aussie audience, I'll have a bit of a giggle about this, but when I first saw that word MUFON, I didn't have my glasses on and I thought it was MUFON, and I was having a bit of a giggle about that for a long time. So now I hope you Americans understand exactly what I'm talking about there. But, yeah, we have a bit of a giggle about that and try and change the words around. But anyway, is there anything before you joined MUFON that is significant that you want to talk about?
Well, during high school, I actually put together what I call my easy access book, because whenever I would talk to some of my relatives or friends, I would be able to show them, yeah, some UFOs do leave vapor trails. Some UFOs do make noise, and you know, and it was almost an inch thick, and just like a collection taken from different books and stuff while I was in high school. And then after a while, I thought about it, and I said, well, what the hell am I going to do with all this? So I was working at a car dealership at the time in 1990, actually. A lot of things happened in 1990. The very same summer before that October month where I had my sighting at the radar base, I met a man by the name of, Don Campbell, but his nickname, his license plate said UFO Don. And he was at the dealership looking for a car in order to trade in his old car. And that's how we met. And I wanted to know, we talked and we exchanged information. And then one particular job that I had to do was also to deliver car parts to body shops and other places like that. And one day they had a show out of Toronto that featured nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman. I made sure to catch the name of the host of the show so that I could later on get a copy of that audio tape. And that's how I got into MUFON. I talked to Stanton Friedman, and he basically said, well, not just because I'm one of the chair people or chairpersons, but I suggest you use your material and gather everything you have and join MUFON. And I did. And for a while, it went okay. I mean, I was a MUFON member from 1991 till about 2011.
And can you explain to the audience what MUFON is and what it stands for, so for those that don't understand?
MUFON is the Mutual UFO Network, and it consists of people that cover 45 fields of sciences that will actually look into UFO sightings and report about them. But the problem I found was that no one other than the membership itself would get to hear about all the case files, because they would publish a monthly journal, which I love to get. I mean, I have, like I said, a lot of issues from 1991 to 2011, and I scanned them all. I said, this information needs to be put out. You know, like if MUFON has like 70,000 plus case files of UFO reports. And also the other thing is, I find that the UFO groups are the worst ones to bitch at the fact that, why isn't anybody believing this? Why isn't anybody looking at the documents, or, you know, knowing that this reality is a reality? Well, it's because they're sitting on information that they should be sharing with the rest of the world. Because when it comes to UFOs, I believe the whole world is concerned. because it's the one question we've been asking ourselves for thousands of years. Are we alone in the universe? And it's a resounding no. The answer is a resounding no. And those groups that have all those journals and case files, it's their responsibility to not only collect the information, but also become educators and use it to educate the rest of the world. So we wouldn't have to be dealing with so much skepticism and debunking.
Yeah, I find that a lot too. That's another pattern that keeps happening too, where I feel the same way, where it all should be shared. But some people kind of want to capitalize on that. And, you know, and I understand that we have certain bills to pay and all that kind of stuff, but it shouldn't be, you know, profited from. It should be maybe a non-profit organization or some other structure so that, you know, we can have a bit of both. But, you know, we had Dr. Jonathan Reed on a couple of weeks ago, and he, when he was going through his major experience, he was in a panic, and he did ring MUFON, and the guys answered him and said, you know, look, we'll meet you at the cafe, you know, tomorrow and blah, 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 and, you know, we'll help you and everything like that. And they didn't show up. And when he rang the number again, it was disconnected. It turned out to be another number. So there was something going on there too. And this is, I think this is like 1996 or something like that as well. Yeah. So he was obviously intercepted. And some sort of trickery went on there as well. So it's a tricky game that everyone's playing with, you know, behind the scenes and stuff. And we're all trying to get it all out so that we can, you know, just dispel the fear. So what happened? How long were you there for?
With MUFON?
Yeah.
From 1991 to 2011, just about.
Oh, okay. And so then, you were there for a while.
Yeah, but I created the website in 2007 with the help of my late web host, who was also a pirate radio legend from the UK. Yeah, he passed away in a few years back. He gave me all the programs that I needed to create the website, and it was the next step. I mean, me not knowing how to write a book, actually, I said, well, it seems to be a lot easier to set up a website. So he gave me all the material that I needed. And within 2 weeks, I already had like 300 pages of newspaper articles actually written in text. And so it was just copy and paste. And then within 2 weeks in 2007, the website was up and running. But then it expanded for just being Northern Ontario stuff. In the last couple of years, I managed to see, my idea is also to salvage, not just salvage, but also preserve, also, which eventually helps in the sharing of information, also preserve other archival work. Like I found the National Archives of Australia, all their UFO documents, and I took every single bundle and I copied them onto my website because I believe that this is precious history. And if owners of websites do die, and then you lose all that information. So to me, it's better to have it backed up at more than just one location only.
That's really interesting. Did you read some of the archives in Australia, and did Pine Gap come up a lot?
I haven't had a chance to see if it came across, but I've heard a lot about Pine Gap in the past.
Yeah,
I'm not surprised that Pine Gap would be the equivalent over there as Area 51 would be to the United States, let's say. Here in Sudbury, well, a lot of people may not know this, but in 1975, starting in July and leading right up to November of 1975, there was a UFO flyover of five military installations, four of which were in the States. And the fifth one, of all places, was the radar base that we used to have here. And some years ago, a radar technician actually contacted me, and he was on the phone. And a little voice said to me, press the record button. So I recorded his voice, and he basically explains how the radar system worked, how far out it extended, and the day that he was there. He says this was not weather propagation. They blamed it a lot on ice crystals in the clouds or Venus and Jupiter as the cause of the sightings, but they were also witnessed by the military personnel there, including himself. And so there's all these sightings at these military installations. It's the first thing you would look at if you were to discover a planet where there's life. You'd be looking for signs of pollution, which would indicate civilization. And second of all, you would try to investigate, like, what are they, where are they at in terms of level of development or militarization? So you'd look at all the military installations and all of their technical facilities. Like here in Sudbury, I don't know if we're still considered the nickel giant of the world. I think we come first. I think Russia is second in production of nickel, but we have the two we had. They've been bought out by other countries. But we used to have Falconbridge Limited and Inco Limited, and these are two large mining giants, and they're both based here in Sudbury, and so the mine sites in the area is what attracts them here. Not as much military. North Bay, which is mentioned in those in the bio that you mentioned at the beginning, North Bay is about 2 hours east of here, and there's a military base there. They used to have nuclear weapons in the 1950s that nobody was aware of.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
American armed, but Canadian manned. So it was Canadian soldiers that were at the base, but the nukes came from the States.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. You know what? I used to live at the bottom of a mountain on the top, when I Google Earthed it, it looked like an old mining construction and with water in it. And I thought that's probably where some of these spaceships come out. So anyway, look, we're going to get on the other side of the break with Michelle. So stick around, guys, and we can hear a lot more about his UFO experiences. Okay.
Real people, real radio. Wherever you are, make it TFR. Truth Frequency Radio.
We're back, and I'm your host, Nikki Colombo, and welcome to the Nikki Colombo Show, and we're talking to Michelle DeChamps. That's how you pronounce your last name, isn't it, sweetie? DeChamps, or is it DeChamps?
Well, we say Deschamps, but that's okay.
Oh, really lovely. Does that mean Michael, Michelle, does that mean Michael of the Champs?
My English teacher used to say that to champs, but no, Deschamps is the fields. If you want a rough translation, apparently the Deschamps family, or the Deschamps lineage, I guess, came over to Canada from France in 1762. I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah, that is very interesting. I'm very, very into. I've got French lineage as well. It goes all the way back to Hugh Dupin. Which was the co-founder of the Knights Templar and the King of Jerusalem. So our lineage goes all the way back 1,000 years, and my mum discovered that, which was absolutely amazing. No wonder I'm so fascinated about all these esoteric topics, but also being a starseed too, I also have gone way off planet and gone all the way back, and I found out that I've got connections to Andromeda, Pleiades, and Sirius, not just one constellation, I guess you would call it. Have you discovered and gone into any of your lineages off-world? And would you consider yourself a lightworker and starseed? Have you had any, you know, like funny marks left on your body or anything like that, or any MyLab experiences or anything like that?
No, that's the odd thing about this whole thing. I've had sightings of the vehicles, I guess if you want to call them that, but I've never seen the occupants, although I do know somebody who has. But no, I've never had regression done. I did want to sort of go back to that first sighting to get to either if I could bring out more detail or to confirm that it really happened. But then I have the documents to confirm that I must have seen something. But no, I don't. It's funny though. Some of the byproduct of having had a sighting or an encounter has made some people telepathic. I know that when I used to buy or get any kind of UFO material, which is inanimate, I mean, I would know almost down to the day when it would show up in the mailbox. It was just weird. I just knew certain things I can sense and other things I'm totally oblivious to.
Yeah, so. You know what? I hear that a lot from a lot of us starseeds and UFO contactees that our ESP tends to go through the roof. And I think it's because, you know, we become consciously aware of everything when, in fact, everything has always been consciously aware of us, but we just didn't know it at the time. And once you start to tap into those abilities, they get stronger and stronger and stronger. What do the occupants look like that you got? You said from your friend actually saw what some of those occupants looked like in one of the ships.
Well, it was actually Don Campbell that told me the story. He's had two encounters with, two encounters or two observations of occupants. It wasn't in an abduction scenario type thing. It was actually one particular time. Like he was a skeptic until 1966 when he had a lot of sightings. The sightings were starting to pick up then, leading up to 1967, which was a worldwide UFO wave. 1967.
That's when I was born. Oh, my God. Yeah. Now everyone knows how young I am. Yeah. No wonder I was born in that year. There you go. Thanks for that.
And in one particular sighting that he had, like he was working at Inco. So he was a tradesperson. He was a welder, a master welder, welding different alloys and metals. And he normally worked 4 to 12 midnight, so 4 in the afternoon till 12 midnight. Then after that, he'd go around and get a hamburger. And then when the sightings started, well, he would be keeping track of them. And on this one particular night, I believe he was in his backyard, and he was there with his best friend from work, whom I've never spoken to. And I don't think he would talk to me about his own encounters, but they were both there with a 600 power telescope, and this object came into view. And so he turned the telescope onto the object, and you can actually look right through the porthole. And even though the UFO was brightly lit on the inside, the saucer, you couldn't make out the facial features, but he noticed that four of them were dressed in silver suits and one guy was dressed in black. So he assumed he was the leader.
Did they look human or did they have big heads? Could he see an outline of a big head or did they look more human?
No, not so much. They were upright. They were standing, and there was like a large panel of lights and like a control panel right behind them. And so these beings were standing. They weren't sitting at seats or anything like that. So that's what he noticed. But he says they were so brightly lit he couldn't even tell if the heads could have been, because there's so much variation in. If you look on my humanoids page on my website, I've actually had to separate the sighting of the occupants from the abduction performing ones, the repeat offenders, as I call them. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know what he actually from one of Leonard Stringfield's status reports that was written in the 1990s or the late 80s. There was a sketch in there that closely resembled one of the beings that he saw with his wife. But these other five ones that he saw on board the hovering saucer before it slowly moved away, you couldn't really tell in any of the features because the interior was so brightly lit. But he could tell that the one he assumed was a leader was dressed in black and the other four ones were dressed in silver. the encounter with his wife that he had. He was coming back from his mother's place after having had supper, and where they live now, at the time it was a very lonely subdivision. There was only three homes that were being built, including his, and this weird vehicle followed him up the hillway up to the house, and it looked like a vehicle. I mean, for 1975, though, he says the vehicle looked like a very futuristic-looking car, but it made no sound and it had an eerie white glow to it. And the occupant behind the steering wheel looked as if it was poorly trying to disguise itself with this big wig that could just slide right off its head. And the hands were, covered in gloves.
Sounds like a drag queen.
Oh, yeah. Would have been one hell of a weird looking drag queen because, yeah.
A drag queen ET, now that's a new concept. Oh, you're going to have to put a new section on your website for that one, please, that's for sure.
Yeah. The surprising thing about that one is that his wife is the one that was more of a skeptic in all this, and yet she's the one who received a telepathic message from the creature, not him. Whatever it said to her, she was passing out, and he quickly got out of the car and went around the other side just in time to catch his wife in his arms. And as the car-looking thing moved off, and he wanted to follow it, but his wife had apparently heard about abduction cases back then and said, no, you're not following that thing because you never know if you're going to come back or not. So that was one of the regrets that he's had, but... he's the one who actually told me to look in the Sudbury Star archives, the newspaper archives, sure enough, he was right. It took me 2.5 years to look through, starting in June of 1947, and I stopped at December of 1989 because then it was too far in between for the next clipping to show up. I was reading more newspapers than I was finding UFO news clippings. So I decided to cut it off at December of 89, and I found over 352 clippings. And it included, I was looking for airship sightings of the 1800s, 1896, 1897. There was a massive wave of what they call these airship sightings in the States and elsewhere. Didn't find anything in the 1800s, but in March of 1914 and 1916, I found two reports. And later on, people would say, well, that was probably planes because, you know, the Wright brothers had flown like on the 5th, on 1905. I said, well, I found a clipping. I didn't photocopy it, sadly, but it said that their first flight from anywhere to anywhere in Canada, at least, was in 1919. So whatever was flying around at night, 1914 and 1916, wasn't ours. Especially with a light on and everything else, you know. So, and one actually was following the railroad track into Sudbury, and one telegraph operator would contact the next one, telling him this object was coming down the line.
You know, I've seen something similar. I was coming home from a gig one night with a friend of mine, and I started to realize once I started talking about this UFO subject that it would actually bring them in. And he had never seen anything like you know, an orb. And or an actual sighting, and we'd finished very late at night. It was probably about 2 o'clock in the morning. We were driving back to the Gold Coast from Brisbane, and there was this orb right in front of us, and it was leading us all the way down the road. And I said, "Have a look at that, Tony. See what happens." You start talking about it, and they appear, and it just it glided along like a puck. On an ice skating rink, you know, doing hockey. It was so, you could tell it was so slippery, and it was like it was leading us all the way down the road. Now it takes about an hour to get from Brisbane down to the Gold Coast, and so this thing was leading us all the way back home on the road. And here he is, and he's really tall. This guy is an ex-musician friend of mine. Here he is, and he's hanging onto the steering wheel, and he's kind of bending over like an old lady, looking up at this orb all the way down. And he couldn't keep his eyes off it, and he's talking to me, and his mouth has dropped down to the ground, and I'm like, see, I'm not crazy after all.
That's cool.
Isn't that funny? You know, and we always talk about that experience now. And of course, you know, since then, he's seen a lot more of them because he's more open to it. And actually, he's the one that actually sent me the radio show with David Icke, and how my after my Kundalini experience, I was just vacuuming, you know, the house one day, and I'm listening to George Norrie, and George Norrie says to, you know, to David Icke, well, how long has this conspiracy been going on for, David? And David says, oh, well, some people might be shocked to hear this, but this conspiracy has been going on for thousands of years, you know. And at that time, I dropped the vacuum cleaner, and I went, who is this guy, you know? And then, you know, from there, I just springboarded off into all this wonderful esoteric knowledge, which is, and then led into the more of the UFO and ET stuff, and to the point where I'm, doing my radio show here today. So that's that story. And we've got David Icke coming on in the next couple of weeks, and I can't wait to tell him about that dropping of the vacuum cleaner story. So it was just amazing that, like, all my friends started seeing more and more of it, and they're like, you know, oh, I've seen it. And I was like, you know, you're not crazy after all. You know what? I think I need to get a T-shirt with that on or a bumper sticker. Yeah. What do you reckon? Okay. All right. Okay. Now I'm having a bit of a giggle for myself. The guys in the chat room, you being a bit naughty at the moment, so I'm just going to ignore you with your smutty comments and naughty stuff, because we're talking about some serious stuff here, guys. That's going to, you know, educate people in a subject that is really serious, and that keeps blowing open more and more and more and more. I can't believe we're at the stage now where, you know, people are becoming more aware of this subject and not so afraid, and more interested in it, and not afraid to ask questions. So, okay, so Michelle, tell us about some of the highlights of your experiences. Okay, I've just got a heart now. Yes, okay, guys, just keep it clean in the chat room, please, okay? Tell us some of the highlights about your experiences with seeing UFOs and MUFON and everything like that.
Well, the one sighting that actually made me come out of the ufological closet, I guess you'd say, was my second sighting at the base, at the radar base. But it wasn't at the radar base when I first saw it. See, that very same summer when I met Don Campbell, before that led up to the
sighting. And who's Don Campbell again?
Don Campbell is UFO Don. He worked at INCO. He was a master welder. And up until 1966, he was a skeptic. But then after that, he had several sightings, and so much so that he actually was invited out by the captain of the radar base to go and talk to him. And he did tell me, and I have all the recordings. I recorded every single one of his stories in audio, and I have them on my website. And one particular thing that he was shown by a captain at the radar base was an aerial photograph of a jet coming in, a military jet coming in to land at the North Bay base in the early 60s. It was just a few weeks before they presented that picture to him out of his desk at the radar base. And it showed, I guess the jet was way up high, and as it was coming in for a landing, its gun camera took a photograph or several photographs of these three silver ships with little tiny domes on top. So the photograph actually showed, from what he saw, the tops of the saucers, the three saucers, as they were hovering above the base.
Oh my God. So
Don had a lot of contacts with the radar base after that, and he'd been on the radio way back when, but a lot of things led up to having lost his recording. His son was home one day, and I guess Don had the tape reel machine set up so he could play back the radio interview he had done. And I guess one day his son and a little friend came over, and they started playing with the recording machine, and they taped over the interview. So Don has no evidence of him ever being on the radio except for the box of the reel. So anyways, with meeting Don that summer, he also had three issues of these old 1960s Flying Saucer magazines. And so I was at the car dealership photocopying them, having access to the photocopying machine. And as I'm done at about 8:30 at night in October of 1990, October 9th, I'm walking to my car diagonally, because the way where it was located on the parking lot, And I saw this big bright light in the sky looking south towards Sudbury, because my small town, well, Hanmer, is in the valley, and the valley is north, about 20 kilometers north of the city of Sudbury. And I'm looking south, and I see this object, which would be best described as Jupiter at its most brightest. But the odd thing about this was that it was, if you stood still and looked at it, it was actually gradually coming down and also getting brighter, which gave me the indication that it was coming down at an angle towards my eyes. And then it stopped right over the crest of the hills in the distance, because there's a lot of hills. Well, of course, you know, mining town. And for a while, even the astronauts came here in the 70s to train, because it looked like the surface of the moon. We had done so much mining and land erosion because we had cut down the trees to rebuild the town in Chicago in the 1800s, that all the tall trees being gone, well, it just led to erosion. So for the longest time, until they started regreening the area, it looked like the surface of the moon. So I'm looking at the hilltop in the distance at this object, and it's slowly just hovering there but moving. And then I came back to tell one of the salespeople. I says, there's something flying there, and I'm going to go and check it out. The salesperson looked at it, shrugged his shoulder, and just walked away. I said, okay, well, I guess he doesn't care about it. So as I was driving down the hill, from, because this dealership was located on a hilltop, so I'm driving down towards my parents' house, and I could see the object between the houses in the distance. And then I grabbed my binoculars, and I quickly told my dad, I think there's a flying saucer hovering between Sudbury and Hanmer. I says, I'm going to check it out. And the neighbor was there, and he's kind of smirked and laughed. So I went to a neighboring street, which led into the woods. And being October, where all the trees were bare of leaves, there's no leaves on the trees, and I'm looking with my binoculars through the branches, and the object is there. And all of a sudden, I could see it move left to right, like three times, and then it stopped, and then it blinked out. So I thought, oh, shit, there's a branch in my way. So I'm crouching down even lower, and it's not there. And all of a sudden, I see it reappear a little lower, but at a different location. So I said, holy crap. So I said, well, this is BS. I'm in the woods. I should go at another high point, because we have a lot of hills. So I drove to another hill where I could get a better view of it. And by the time I got there, I'm looking around and everything, as I'm driving safely, and I can't see the object. And then I'm panning from west to east, because that location where I stopped, the radar base was located to my southeast of me. And I'm looking west, panning towards the east. And that's when I see this odd light. It wasn't the same thing. It wasn't just a little white egg anymore. It looked like an irregularly pulsating pinkish red light located exactly where the base would be. And the only reason I know the base was, it was exactly over the base, the radar base, is because the lampposts along the highway would show me where the base used to stand. And so I'm looking at this object, and yeah, like I said, it changed. It was a different color. It pulsated not quite like a heartbeat, a little bit more irregular. And my knees started to buckle. So I leaned my elbows onto the roof of my car just to stabilize the binoculars. And I looked at it, and then I thought, stupidly, I thought it was going to be there a long while. So I got back in the car to go get witnesses at the house. And of course, when we came back, it was gone. So I don't know how it took off, if it went up vertically or if it went to a neighboring town. But I dropped off my mom and my brother, and then I went out again to see if I could find the object, but never did. So I've learned a lot in very little time. Like, you can't assume you're seeing a UFO within seconds. You may have to stand outside for an hour and watch how it came in, watch the maneuvers. Try to listen for sound. That's why I've created a whole bunch of pages on my website that you wouldn't see anyplace else on any other website. UFO characteristics. What are the 8 or 9 characteristics to look for in a UFO sighting if you think you're having one? Lack of sound, direction of movement, the way it rapidly leaves the area, or the way it rapidly comes into the area. So these are all things that I've learned throughout all these experiences that I've had. And it was important to put it down, because a lot of people, well, especially the naysayers, will say, oh, you just saw something for a few seconds and you think right away it's a UFO. Well, it's on the same token, you look at all the UFO footage on YouTube, and 95% of them are all fake. Why? Because the people who are faking them have never had a sighting. They don't know what UFOs actually look like. They're so plain Jane, you get bored after a while. They don't have all kinds of protuberances or things coming out of them like you'd expect to see on a small scale model used for a science fiction film, for instance. So I'm able to tell pretty well when something is CGI while looking at YouTube. There's certain things, certain sightings have actually perked my interest. I've kept a few where there were supposed UFOs filmed from through the porthole of an airliner by passengers. I have three of those footages on my website. I've asked somebody who's really good with CGI to let me know if I have anything fake on my website, and I would remove it instantly. I usually use old photographs from the 50s and 60s and 70s because, unlike digital photos, they cannot be played with. They have negatives that were tested to death. And that's the one thing I can't find any sense in. You may have somebody today that say, oh, we have new photographic equipment. Let's see if we can't run these old photos through it again. It's as if they're trying to nitpick at something that's been genuinely authenticated as a genuine UFO. And they just won't rest until it's debunked or something. That's the impression I seem to get from all that.
So I've had that too, yeah.
So because of all the speculations that's going on, whether we've been on Mars for the last 40 years, whether or not we have a star fleet or a fleet of UFOs that have been back engineered, I have my doubts about that. But until you can prove one way or the other, people will say all kinds of things. It's the modern day version of the UFO contactees of the 50s, where they could say, oh, I went on a ride on a flying saucer with a Venusian and a Martian. And we hadn't been there yet with probes and rovers and things like that. So until we went there, anybody could say anything, and you couldn't say no or yes. So we're stuck in the same thing, but a more modern day version of it. And I think I'm going to be forced to stay behind with the older data because it's more reliable than anything new that's coming out now, because you got all these people coming up with fantastic stories and there's no backup. There's no evidence. There's no documentary evidence for it. Even the back engineering, I mean, Bob Lazar, I believe Bob Lazar to a T. And when he says that as 1989, we could not duplicate the propulsion system using earthly materials, and this technology may be millions of years ahead of us, not just 400 years or 50 years or 100 years. I have my doubts that we're able, you know, just because you have, like, if they found all these old flying saucers built by the German Nazis, it could be like a concept vehicle. You could have the drawings, all the drawings you want. Doesn't mean that it went into production, you know? Making a drawing is easy. Going from a drawing to actually building the object itself and making it work the way you think it should work, that's two different things. But people don't see it that way. Right away, they'll jump to the Vril technology, the Nazi technology, and then they'll just go rampant from there, you know, with no proof whatsoever. So I said, oh, boy, and it's bad enough that we have the skeptics to deal with and the debunkers without having all these people making up stories that we can't verify one way or the other. Now, whether or not – I'm not saying we haven't come along in a long way. I mean, look at the cell phones we have now. I mean, obviously, if you were to show somebody in the 60s that we have cell phones, they would have thought, oh, wow. But then you look at Star Trek, they have the communicators that more or less looked like the same thing as a flip phone we used to have. I don't doubt that kind of technology, but in terms of large size vehicles that can move silently and do the same maneuvers as real UFOs, I don't believe it. Not for a sec. So,
I'm hearing you, babe. I'm certainly hearing you. Okay, well, we've got another break, and we are going to be on the other side with Michelle DeChamps. And we're going to be talking more about ET experiences. So stick around, guys. On the other side, we're on the Mickey Colombo Show, TFRLive.com.